All right, welcome listeners. This is day 31 of the lockdown in New York City, episode 17 of Know Your Enemy, and 420.
Oh, hell yeah, baby.
So it's quite a confluence of various energies and, you know, astrological signs and numbers involved here.
Oh, yeah. We are on the verge of Taurus season, which is my season when I'm the least well-behaved.
Oh, really? Is that so?
kind of. I became, you know, slothful and avaricious.
Oh, misbehave in that sense.
Acquisitive.
Because I was searching my memory, Sam, and thinking, I feel like we've misbehaved in all seasons of the year at all times.
By the way, I'm Sam Adler-Bell. I'm here with my co-host, Matt Sittman. Here's my question. Are you partaking in the rituals of the holiday or not?
Absolutely not. Not before I podcast.
No. Okay. Yeah. You would never do such a thing.
No, but I am drinking whiskey, of course, and settling in for a very special episode, which is to say the mailbag episode.
Mailbag.
Yes. And this is fitting because it was just about a year ago that we launched Know Your Enemy out into the world.
That's so beautiful.
May 6th, 2019. The first Know Your Enemy episode was released.
Yeah, the Age of Innocence.
Yeah, I have to admit, I have gone back and listened to it. And, well, I don't recommend it, Sam, if you haven't.
To be perfectly honest. I have no inclination to do that.
Yeah, see, I'm a masochist. Sam knows this, but listeners, you might not be that surprised to learn that, given how neurotic and occasionally perfectionist I am, I go back and listen to them and kind of make notes.
No, God, that's terrible.
I know. It's really a sickness.
Well, I'm sick too, and terribly neurotic and terribly self-conscious, but living inside of my own brain for 29 years has taught me like defensive measures. Mm-hmm. Like I know not to do that sort of thing. And I don't. I will not listen to that episode. I bet the music's good, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So this is great. So it's a year into the podcast, 17 episodes in front of the paywall, many more behind the Patreon paywall, which I'll just say right now, people who want more Know Your Enemy in these troubling and often boring and lonely times can sign up to get more bonus content from us at patreon.com/knowyourenemy, patreon.com/knowyourenemy. But 17 episodes in, 1 year in, and finally we're going to respond to some of the questions that our listeners, our loyal, long-suffering, beloved listeners have submitted to us.
Well, we messaged our Patreon subscribers, and I think we put out on Twitter that we were taking questions for a mailbag episode, and many of you did write in, and I have to say, I had to laugh. It was great. You're all such nerds.
My God.
Like there were almost no questions about my personal life or Sam's personal life, or silly questions about, like, you know, where's the favorite city we've ever visited, or, you know, what do you like having for brunch? It was just like diving into a lot of very nerdy, often highly specific questions. And it was really great to hear from all of you, but it was funny how serious and again, often like subconsciously intellectual the questions were. It was something.
It was no surprise to me. And also, I think it speaks well of the fact that we have utterly failed to create a cult of personality around ourselves on the podcast.
I know.
And people are just genuinely interested in the content that we provide to them.
We're empty ciphers, just semi-anonymous conduits for information. And, you know, although Sam, I did have one of my good friends say, Matt, you know, Sam has considerably more charisma than you do.
No.
he did. He was being serious, too.
How did he come to that conclusion? I don't find that to be true at all.
Anyways, it was just funny.
Well, listeners, tweet at us. Whether or not you believe it, tell Matt that he's very charismatic and much, much more so than me for the sake of his well-being and mine.
Please do not do that. But all that was, again, that was just me talking about the kind of questions we got. And I did think it was interesting and kind of funny.
I know. I love it.
So let's get to him.
Thank you. To begin with, we're going to start with our most beneficent listeners, the Patreon subscribers. Should we start with one of these questions from Ben?
Yeah, let's do it. Ben from Patreon.
So Ben from Patreon asks, which living right-wing intellectual do you think has the best understanding of the contemporary American left? This is a very good question.
It is a good one, and I'm not sure I have a answer ready at hand. I mean, I guess the kind of the number of right-wing intellectuals in general I read seriously or take seriously and read regularly is kind of dwindling. And so I suppose in this sense I might say someone like Ross Douthat, in the sense that I think he genuinely is interested in some of the debates on the left. And if you asked him to give you an overview of the kind of the different factions and approaches on the left, I think he could probably do so.
And he's forced to be surrounded by, you know, heathens at the New York Times.
Yeah. I guess another way of getting at the question, though, I was thinking about it from the perspective of, remember a few days ago, Noam Chomsky said he would vote for Biden.
Yeah.
Right. So every 4 years this happens where Noam Chomsky makes an extremely basic argument about like the calculations involved in voting for a Democrat you don't love. Right. It happens every four years.
But yeah, so funny. Somebody did a good tweet that was like, poor Noam Chomsky, ignored by the liberal media, the mainstream media all year round until every 4 years he gets to say the most basic, obvious thing about whether you should vote for a Democrat over a Republican in the presidential contest.
Yeah. But I was going to say, I was thinking about Noam Chomsky because I'm reading through one of his books, a collection of his essays, and he was in the news. And I realized that when I was on the right, Noam Chomsky is like a punchline.
Hmm.
Like the kind of the name you would drop into a sentence if you were trying to name a ridiculous left-wing intellectual in a pejorative way, right?
Yeah.
The same way right-wingers talk about, you know, maybe Howard Zinn, right? Or like the people's history of the United States. Like it's one of those things that has like stands in on the right for a caricature of the left. And and I was thinking, wow, like Chomsky, it's really quite something that I learned so little about what he actually stood for. And that his ideas were taken so unseriously on the right. And so I was just thinking about like, well, what figures on the left did I really feel like the right taught me something interesting about? And there's not many.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I'm kind of thinking about this question from the perspective of me as a young conservative looking at the left, I don't think I was really taught to take seriously any left-wing intellectuals.
Right.
And the only ones I were basically the dead ones who had at some point, like in the 1950s, like kind of joined the so-called right side of the Cold War.
Right.
And so if you were like enough of an anti-communist and kind of did most of your work before the 60s and like cultural issues, you know, those fragmented in a certain way, then the right might say a few good words about you.
One thing that occurred to me is I don't really read much of the actual editors at American Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
People like Julius Krein, but they publish so many left-wing thinkers there.
Yeah, that's another good point.
So like some of the names on the front page of American Affairs right now, Matt Stoller on the war within corporate America, James mm-hmm. Galbraith on the past and future of mm-hmm. antitrust, Michael Lind,
mm-hmm.
a kind of natural fit for them in some ways.
Yeah, he really is.
Gladden Papin, who is one of the other editors that I was trying to think of. David Adler, a person who was on the podcast on Korean industrial policy, Samuel Moyn on foreign power, Phil Cly, a friend of the pod, also on foreign affairs.
Huh.
The point being that like American Affairs is a place where right-wing and left-wing ideas meet and commingle and engage with each other in a way that is pretty unique as an outlet at this point. I don't want to be just like hyping American Affairs because they also do some pretty weird stuff.
I think it's possible to both have a critical stance toward them while appreciating the things they publish that are worth thinking about. And also, in the context of this question, to say that they probably do understand the left's arguments as well as anyone on the right. I think because they're searching for an economic message that kind of absorbs some of the left critique, but really is distinguishable from like what a socialist program would be.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think to make those distinctions, you have to know something about what the left is really arguing and where you want to provide an alternative to it. while still critiquing and you know, kind of leaving behind libertarianism in terms of right-wing economics.
Exactly.
Here's another question from Patreon. People talk a lot about the I'm reading now. People talk a lot about the unorthodox conservatism of Joan Didion or Louis Farrakhan. Those would both make great episodes, by the way. Yes, probably right. But do you guys have a hot take or read on any other eccentric conservatives sort of hiding in plain sight?
Yeah, this is a good question.
That's a really interesting question.
I like that you call him Louis Farrakhan, like he's your pal.
I know, sorry. Louis Farrakhan, I'm sorry.
Busting your balls, man.
I know.
Do you have a good one for this?
First of all, I'm not sure if these days people's politics are how easy they are to hide.
Yeah.
You know, it just seems like with social media, the way anyone's comments are captured and transmitted so quickly, it's harder to keep your politics under wraps. Whereas you can imagine a certain kind of, let's say, novelist or film producer, or director, or writer, you know, making their art and then being largely unknown.
Yeah.
Or being very well managed by, you know, the relatively limited media and whoever their public relations people were or whatever, you know? So I think the era in which it's easy to hide your politics might be coming to a close, but I think there's another way of getting at the question, which is that even based on what we know about people, might there be a kind of more personal conservatism, even if it's not a political conservatism? And I did have a couple answers. One was, I might nominate Marilyn Robinson.
Yeah. She is claimed by the right sometimes, but she's also claimed very much by people like Barack Obama.
Yes. I mean, because her politics are explicitly pretty Obama-esque.
Yeah.
I would describe, and I think that's, you know, so my criticisms of Marilyn Robinson politically are often quite similar to what they might have been of Obama.
John Thomason, a friend of the show, wrote a good essay for The Point about this phenomenon exactly, Barack Obama and Marilyn Robinson.
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
But I do think at a more aesthetic and kind of personal, almost at the level of instinct, I mean, she has a deep reverence for the past.
Yeah.
Her novels can be oddly apolitical sometimes. Like in her second novel, Home.
A Home, yeah.
Like you see this, like glimpses of the civil rights movement happening like on a television.
Yeah.
But it seems far away, you know, until, of course, you know, as that novel unfolds, race plays a more complicated factor.
Yep.
But there's just a way in which I think her novels can be apolitical in a way that sometimes borders on complacency. And I think given also her kind of general intellectual attitudes and instincts, she can be, her politics are explicitly progressive, but I think some of her own instincts might have a weird conservatism to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, to make the choice to sort of set that triptych of novels in this like small town, sort of like struggling with faith and communitarian questions of community and faith, sort of bespeaks a conservative disposition.
Yeah, disposition is a good word to use too, I think, in this context.
What do you make of her sort of more recent preoccupation with Calvinism?
Oh, I think she's a really, well, I'll put it this way. The reason I became Catholic is because I was hoping Marilyn Robinson's version of Calvin would be true, but it isn't.
Wait, you have to unpack that for people less knowledgeable.
No. So Marilyn Robinson has written a number of really, truly wonderful essays on John Calvin. I mean, she's read an incredible amount about Calvin's own life, but also the history of that period, the early modern period, the Reformation, kind of the rise of the Dutch Republic, so on and so forth. So she really has written compellingly about Calvin. But as she puts it in Gilead, or as the narrator, John Ames, puts it in Gilead, you know, everyone kind of creates God in their own image. And Marilyn Robinson, through John Ames, says Calvin's was a kind of Frenchman and like Renaissance humanist.
And so
instead of the kind of, you know, Max Weber, like disenchanting, kind of punishing Calvinist work ethic, Marilyn Robinson gives us this like humanist Renaissance Calvin that is like deeply aesthetic and reads the beauty, like sees God in the beauty and grandeur of the world. And it's really this lovely view of Calvin that I ended up, just, I wish it were true, but it's not quite.
It's not quite.
I have one more I was going to offer, but I wanted to see if you had any.
Well, I think this is sort of something that we shouldn't dwell on too much, but which is, and it probably perhaps obvious to the listeners, but there's a variety of sort of nominally leftist instinct among certain writers, podcasters, and so on, who clearly have like a visceral disdain for a certain kind of what they would describe as woke liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
So like, this comes out in the Red Scare podcast, people like Michael Tracy online. It's taking what is a worthwhile critique of the way in which identity politics provides a cover for neoliberal economic policy sometimes. You know, it's like the Adolf Reed criticism that like the ideal version of politics for the neoliberal woke identity politics is corporate boards are still in charge of everything, but there's 10% African American people and there's 50% women, and it's like equal distribution of identities across. So, which is a legitimate criticism.
Sure. Yeah.
That being said, there's a variety of like irksome response to anything that even sniffs of like identity politics, when it manifests as sort of people who say like, oh, trans inclusive politics is exclusively an elite phenomenon that like only that working class people as a whole don't give a shit about. And when Democrats like ever talk about like trans inclusion, like when Elizabeth Warren like did her speech where she talked about trans women being killed, that was sort of like treated as the epitome of like this woke corporate myopia. And I think that basically comes from a conservative place. It comes from a place of discomfort with, you know, changing gender politics and norms, and attributing animosity towards changing gender politics and norms to this fantasy of the working class, which is basically the like Trumpist white man patriarch. I think that's basically like ventriloquizing the working class in the interest of your own basic conservative ideas.
Right. Are you interested in my second choice?
I am, yes.
And he's dead, but I the more I thought about it, the more I would just wanted to say something briefly about him, which is Gore Vidal. And I realized, you know, probably Gore Vidal's single greatest literary achievement was his series of novels about the United States. And for anyone to immerse yourself in the past of your own country in that way, I think it reflects both a deep patriotism and a certain sensibility. And in a lot of ways, Gore Vidal's politics were sometimes almost like a populist, the Republic betrayed kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like it wasn't the same as like a socialist critique of American empire or, you know, certain views on the left. It had this populist, like his grandfather was a senator from Mississippi, I believe. You know, it really had that Jeffersonian Republic source of his for his politics. And I think that can map onto a certain version of conservatism sometimes too. Or be kind of kissing cousins with it. Yeah, Gore Vidal would be another one. Just the more that I thought about it, his relationship to U.S. history, you know, what he spent his time writing, and just some of his own politics. He clearly was, you know, on the left in some sense, but I think it often came from a strange place.
Yeah.
Or an interesting mix of influences. And he was himself someone trapped in the past. You know, he fell in love with a boy in high school who was killed in the war and,
right,
you know, never quite got over that. And so I think the role of nostalgia in the past in his imagination really loomed large as well.
Right. So I thought that Gore Vidal is a good transition to a question that we got from a few different people, including Dan over email and Matthew and Keith from Patreon, about conservative novelists. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I thought of when you were talking about Gore Vidal is that in some ways, like, nostalgia and a sense of sort of living one's life with the past occupying a place of like vibrant aesthetic, mm-hmm, personal and moral importance in one's life is a conservative disposition in many ways, it's also sort of a prerequisite for being a good novelist in many cases.
I think so, yeah.
Which is why I find it sort of notable that there are so few sort of contemporary literary novelists.
Maybe with the exception of that guy, Mark Halperin, not to be confused with Mark Halperin, the MSNBC sex pest,
who could be easily identified as conservative.
In which sense? The more personal sense or the kind of specifically political sense?
I think in the specifically political sense, and then maybe that just goes back to what you were saying earlier, that there is still the capacity for people to sort of hide their political...
But just to be clear, Sam, you're saying a number of people asked us if we knew of conservative novelists.
A couple of different people asked us for examples of conservative novelists, writers, mm-hmm. that we particularly enjoyed, you know, either despite sure. their politics or in some ways, you know, maybe because of the conservative disposition that's represented in their work.
I have a few examples if you want to talk about them, both living and dead. Yeah,
yeah, and I want to talk about mine too. So let's talk about our faves.
Well, I mean, this is a mostly 20th century novelist. He's been dead not that long, a few years. But I was going to say Saul Bellow probably would count. I mean, I think we know in his personal life he was, you know, probably, I think you could call him something of an attenuated neocon.
Yeah.
And I say this for a number of reasons. For one thing, I think he's also part of a, you might say sociologically, he taught at the Committee on Social Thought for many years at the University of Chicago. You know, one of his last major, I don't know if it was his last novel, but one of his very last novels was his Roman Aklef about Alan Bloom, Ravelstein.
That's right. Oh my God. We had to read that. I have never read that.
And Bloom, of course, you know, played a major role kind of as a conservative figure in the culture wars and specifically the kind of war over political correctness in academia.
Yeah.
In the 80s, that iteration of it. And we know kind of from anecdotes that Bellow, I told this anecdote on a bonus episode, but of the time Martin Amis took Christopher Hitchens to dinner at Bellow's. And one of the details of that story is that there was a copy of Commentary sitting out on the table.
Right.
You know, Bellow once said, what's that line? Like, who's the Proust of the Zulus?
He said, who's the Tolstoy of the Zulus?
Who's the Tolstoy of the Zulus?
And right. Who's the Proust of the Papuans?
You know, so, and I think he got crankier with age. And I think he also, you know, was something of a fairly strong Zionist too. So I think there's just a constellation of things there with Bellow that it probably would be fair. You wouldn't want to reduce him to, you know, just being a political conservative. He was a great novelist, but I do think he would be a novelist you could point to and say it's probably fair to call him a political conservative.
Right, and sort of a political conservative in specifically the like historical and cultural context in which the neocons became conservative, right?
Yes.
Like if everyone has listened to our episode on Norman Podoritz, who notably gave a bad review to Bellow, to Augie March, is sort of this conservative, or who became a conservative after having had the like specific New York Jewish immigrant experience mm-hmm. in his family. But then over the course of the 20th century, that variety yeah. of mm-hmm. of white ethnic political experience produced a bunch of conservatives, of which he might have been representative.
Right. And there's a line I like from Leo Strauss, speaking of Straussians and kind of
Bloom,
Bloom, but Bellow being in their orbit at the University of Chicago, Nathan Tarkov, among others. I want to say it was in a letter to Wilmore Kendall, but it was in some correspondence that after, I want to say Strauss wrote a letter to the editor of National Review having something to do with Zionism in Israel.
Yeah.
But Strauss claimed he had the odor of conservatism about him. And that line, the odor of conservatism, I like it because it's like Leo Strauss was a political philosopher.
Right.
You know, there's some sense in which it would, you know, be something of an injustice to just slap a label on him. But I like the odor of conservatism because I think you hear it and you know what it means.
Yeah. I have one that's sort of in a similar vein because it is somebody who's literary work I admire to an almost rhapsodic degree, but whose beliefs about Israel are completely abhorrent to me, and that's Cynthia Ozick. who people might not be as well aware of her right-wing Zionist ideas, but they're pretty terrible. But she is one of the greatest short story writers, I think, alive today, and maybe to ever do it, or in the 20th century. And some of her best work is very much rooted in Jewish historical experience, the Holocaust, her short story, The Shawl, and then the novella that developed from that is one of the most amazing things I've ever read. But she also, you know, was famous for saying things like, you know, in the aughts, I think in the Wall Street Journal, she said, "By replacing history with fantasy, the Palestinians have invented a society unlike any other, where hatred trumps bread." And she goes on to sort of describe how, like, basically Palestinian children are being raised to be, like, homicidal maniacs and, you know, devoid of humanity, and has basically defended Israel's morally indefensible approach to the occupation over and over again in a more kind of pathetic way, praised Barry Weiss's terrible book, or at least blurbed it. I hope, just for the sake of, like, Ozick's, like, quality as a critic, because she's also a great literary critic, that she did not actually read the prose in Barry Weiss's book when she gave the blurb. So Cynthia Ozick is in my category, though it's not that she wrote a bunch of, like, right-wing Zionist stories. Her stories don't necessarily represent her political affinities as much as her public statements do.
I would just, to that end, we don't need to go on at length about this, but I would say someone whose work itself conveys maybe even more than conservative, I would say a reactionary political message, and that would be the French novelist Michel Houellebecq.
Yes.
If you were looking for another, like, contemporary, still writing example, I haven't read his new one, Serotonin. I did read Submission, and I have to say, quite liked it.
Excellent.
I'm not saying that I mean that in the sense of, as a novel, I found it quite compelling. And I've read his first one called Whatever, or the title's title in French is quite long. The English version, it was just Whatever. But I don't remember much of it because I bought it in Paris at Shakespeare and Company. And, like, it's a very slim short novel. So I kind of drunkenly paged through it a few evenings. But I think he would be on this list too for me.
He also sort of represents something that we haven't really acknowledged, though in different contexts we have said it before, which is that a certain kind of conservative is very attuned to the excesses and, in some ways, the absurdities of a certain kind of liberalism, which he is. You know, like, that's in some ways his project. That's why Submission is a kind of devastatingly funny and also scary novel, in the same way that certain conservatives, intellectuals, political writers are worth reading because they are attuned to that frequency in liberalism, you know, the not being able to take its own side in argument.
Sort of Nietzschean Last Men.
The death drive in liberalism. He's worth reading for that reason. Though, if you were to build your politics around Houellebecq's novels, you would be a pretty terrifying person, in my opinion.
And some of his own political interventions have been rather pathetic.
Terrible.
But, shall we move on?
One more, which is the most very, very obvious one, but for whom I do have a special affection, is Evelyn Waugh.
For sure.
As the sort of, like, Tory novelist, but also a brilliant writer and hilarious, and sort of depictions of old guard aristocrats, which, like, in one sense, that's the world he inhabited and chose to inhabit and wouldn't have wanted to inhabit any other world, but also, you know, depicted their absurdities and obsessions and inanities as well, maybe despite his political sympathies. But as far as, like, a comic absurdist snob.
And I was going to say, Sam, at least he actually did inhabit that milieu.
Yeah.
What's vexing are the Americans who often are, like, converts to Roman Catholicism and kind of fancy themselves the remnant, keeping alive the kind of...
They cosplay as Tories.
Yeah, the old school gentlemen. And of course, they all love Evelyn Waugh. I think there's a way in which you should read Evelyn Waugh on his own terms before letting terrible American Catholics ruin him for you.
Very good, yes. All right, moving on.
Okay, this is an interesting one. This is from Leo. This is a Patreon. Leo from Patreon. I thought this was, it's a, you know, a counterfactual, but this can be fun. Dear Matt and Sam, I love your podcast and hope my questions are... I can skip that.
No, he said, hope my question is approved by your Buckland gatekeeping, which it has been.
It has been, yes. The very severe and meticulous vetting process.
Yeah.
Anyways, so how do you think the Bush administration and American conservatism would have developed if the attacks of 9/11 had not happened?
That's a fascinating question.
It really is. It really, really is. Sam, do you have any initial thoughts?
Well, I feel like the place to start with it is, like, what was the nature of the George W. Bush 2000 campaign? Mm-hmm. And what did his administration look like? What did its priorities appear to be before 9/11 intervened? And basically, the neocon foreign policy analysts in his administration got together, took over, and instantiated mm-hmm. their worldview upon, you know, not just American foreign policy, but the world. Like, what was Bush, George W. Bushism before 9/11? And you might be better equipped to answer that than I am.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I'm just old enough to really remember that election. It was probably the first presidential election that I paid close attention to. And then over the years, in my young conservative days, I did do a number of research projects on the Bush administration, or at least George W. Bush himself. And what everyone has to remember is that the presidential campaign itself, this was the big question. We have a massive surplus.
Right.
What should we do with it? Bush wanted to put it back in the hands of taxpayers through tax cuts, and Al Gore wanted to put it in a lockbox.
In a lockbox.
And it seemed like...
What a fucking loser.
I know. And Bush campaigned on a humble foreign policy. He was against nation building. And I think you do have to give... I don't want to credit it too much, but I do think compassionate conservatism was trying to offer something different than warmed over libertarianism. It might have been mostly rhetorical. You know, it was kind of premised on this like ownership society idea too, and, you know, faith-based partnerships. And, you know, there are a lot of elements of it that, you know, those of us on the left have reason to be skeptical of. But it was trying to move away, I think, from like Jack Kemp style, you know, more libertarian inflected economics. So that's what Bush ran on. And I'm not sure, and I try to think of this too. You have to remember the Texas governor was not a very powerful position. It's the lieutenant governor in Texas that kind of wields more power. So Bush was a pretty inexperienced guy who had served two terms as governor of a state that where the governor didn't have much power. And he ran this, again, he campaigned on a humble foreign policy, compassionate conservatism. And
he was born again.
Yeah, he was born again. And so I think, I don't know how to best put this, but, you know, Bush brought a lot of Texas people with him. People who I think were a little bit more evangelically minded.
Yeah.
People like Karen Hughes. Rove came with him, but he was, of course, just an operator. I don't know. Maybe I'm just spinning my wheels here, Sam.
Well, no, I think that's interesting. I think people forget that sort of Bush disposition pre-9/11 is something that's sort of lost to history. I think it's notable that No Child Left Behind was the legislative priority.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And that passed the House of Representatives in May, so mm-hmm. so well before 9/11. It ultimately mm-hmm. was signed after, but this kind of big intervention in standards in right. elementary and secondary education was a big priority, and that mm-hmm. was though there have been, you know, there's just like lots of excellent critiques of that law and the way that it's played mm-hmm. out in terms of testing and teachers union's opposition to it. The instinct on the right that came from the compassionate conservative impulse more so than right. from mm-hmm. a libertarian impulse. They weren't trying to get rid of the education department. They were trying to change it in such a way that there were more standards, and they talked about it in terms of lifting up the neediest schools, right? So
yeah, and around that same time, Sam, Bush, there was a lot of talk of course, George W. Bush spoke Spanish. He was from Texas, and there was the talk of the inroads he would make with Hispanic and Latinx voters.
Yes,
you know, so it was an entirely different conversation. And here's how I would cash out where I'm going with this. I think there are two big elements to the moment we're living through, right? Like two big catastrophes that brought us Trump, the populist uprisings, however you want to put it. The moment we're in, it's 9/11 and it's the financial crash,
yeah.
Right? I don't know how those two relate to each other exactly. I'm not equipped to make that argument. But I think without 9/11, Bush would have been a fairly moderate president that ended up cutting a fair number of deals with Democrats in the House and Senate. And then I don't really know how that cashes out in terms of whether the financial crash happens or if it does, what kind of position the country is in when it does, and how we respond when it happens. I don't know. But I can just imagine Bush being not super ideological himself, wanting to make deals. He did a lot of that stuff in Texas.
Yeah.
You know, I think his instincts were kind of deal cutting, you know, fairly conservative, but willing to, you know, again, like kind of deal with the other side, negotiate. So I don't know. You have to remember, too, Bush lost the popular vote. He only entered office because of highly irregular recount procedures, court proceedings, and then basically the Supreme Court of the United States intervening to choose Bush as president. So I think kind of what happens is he comes in as a only semi-legitimate president, right? I'm sure a lot of people were skeptical.
Yeah, quite unpopular.
And 9/11 is what really made him president, in a sense.
If there was Twitter at the time, certainly people would say, now is the day.
Right, exactly. This is the day George W. Bush really became president. But I do think that means without 9/11, kind of how he's viewed going into 2004.
No, yeah.
You know, do people say, like, this guy really shouldn't have been president anyway? He hasn't really done much.
Yeah.
You know.
He tried to get immigration reform passed and it didn't work or something like that.
Yeah. You know? Like, and so I do think people's kind of real hunger for an alternative, if Bush is never really validated that way by 9/11 or kind of seen as president in a certain way, I just wonder what effect that would have had too.
Right. Which is why it was such a good idea for them to do that inside job.
Right.
You know, to organize that massive conspiracy to you know, defraud the public.
Fire can't melt steel.
Jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
I've
done that experiment in my own house to make sure that it's true, and it is.
Well, Sam, should we move on to the next question?
Yeah.
Okay, now this question, I'm going to combine two of them. One question is from Will from Patreon, and another would be, this person's name is Pixlaw. That's the only name given on their account. This is another Patreon supporter.
Okay.
Basically asked, they both ask about Bernie losing. And I'll just read Will's question where he says, hey guys,
okay,
I don't mean for this to sound hostile, but how do you reconcile your optimism in the episode after the South Carolina debate with the drubbing that was received in that primary and afterwards? Was it wishful thinking or a genuine misreading of the tea leaves? And then the other question from Pixlaw, I won't read it all, but I think that person raises an interesting kind of wrinkle to this, which is he cites a tweet. This Twitter person is named Respectable Lawyer. I don't know who that is. But this is what he said in the tweet. Bernie postmortem, colon. He was winning, and then his opponents did something unprecedented to stop him. Everything else is window dressing. And if Team Biden was smart, they would be making massive efforts to heal the wound caused by that unprecedented move. And then our questioner, Pixlaw, says, what unprecedented things? What the hell? He says, Bernie ran, and he seems to have lost. And in 2016, he ran against Hillary Clinton and lost. The same Hillary Clinton who lost to Obama in 2008. This suggests to me, at least, and then in parentheses says, okay, I'm an oldish progressive white guy, but still, that Bernie didn't actually do that well in his campaigns.
Right, okay.
Since I blathered on about the counterfactuals to 9/11, why don't you get started on this one?
Oh, God. Well,
since you are the electoral politics knower.
That is not.
sometimes reporter.
God damn even, it. Yeah. Well, I have avoided in many ways the Bernie postmortem Twitter. At one point, I said something like, it's probably important to think about what we did wrong and how we could do better. And then a lot of people who have existing grievances against me for my horrible defenses of Elizabeth Warren replied by saying fuck you, no, Bernie didn't do anything wrong, he's perfect.
Bernie didn't fail, the people failed him, he was failed.
Elect a new people, as Brecht said once.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. This is so depressing.
Well, I can say something very narrow.
Okay.
If that gives you a little time to think and maybe you can play off of it.
Sure.
Which is that one thing about South Carolina specifically, I admit that, I mean, I didn't think Bernie would win South Carolina.
Yeah.
Biden did win by more than I was probably would have guessed.
Yeah.
But I will say this, and I think it's in one of the exit polls, that James Clyburn, his endorsement ended up mattering for 50% of voters in South Carolina.
Incredible.
And that came the morning after the debate,
right,
if you recall. That was a Wednesday morning. But I would just say more broadly, I don't think you have to have a very conspiratorial view of things to say that the way in which the kind of institutional Democratic Party got its act together against Bernie, you don't have to have a conspiratorial view of how that unfolded to still really be surprised by how quickly it happened.
Yeah.
And because there's not a previous example of something like that happening in recent electoral politics history, as far as I can tell. So I'm just saying, like, I do think it's still possible to, I don't really retract much of what I said.
Yeah.
I just think we all were a bit taken by surprise by how quickly the kind of Buttigieg and Klobuchar, everyone on dropping out, endorsing Bernie or endorsing Biden. And then I think the thing that did surprise me, maybe we don't have to get into this, but I was surprised that Elizabeth Warren not only stayed in, but stayed in with the help of $11 million in super PAC money.
Yeah, fuck that shit.
And their boy, you know, so I think that specific combination of things really, I just don't know if there was any way to predict it.
But so as regards, like, you know, the idea, unprecedented thing happened and therefore Bernie lost because the party was so, did this nefarious thing that could never have been predicted, and what could we possibly do? I just don't think that's a sufficient way to think about what happened, because of course that was always a possibility. And I think that, you know, frankly, I don't want to talk about it for a long time. It is a profound failure of the Bernie campaign that their approach was to lean in to their existing base. And whether this was coming from the top of the campaign or was just sort of leaking out from different parts of the campaign or from people who supported the campaign online, adopting an attitude of like, if you're not with us, then you're against us, and never pivoting sufficiently when Bernie was a front runner to a very, very magnanimous, like, everybody come on board. We are the Democratic. We are the achievement of the Democratic Party's highest aims historically and politically right now. You know, you just have to eat shit and stop being the outsider, because you, by definition, stop being the outsider when you're winning the Democratic primary. And at that point, it was on Bernie and on his campaign and on his surrogates to shift to an attitude of, whatever you've thought about me in the past, I'm a uniter. I'm the person who can bring this party together and defeat Trump. And of course, there's an argument to be made that, like, even if he had done that, the party would have done everything that they could to try to undermine him. But it was never not foreseeable that the party would do those things. And therefore, the onus was upon the campaign to shift tacts and try to win the primary. And of course, like, the contradiction with Bernie always was that I think that it would have been an advantage of his against Trump that he's doesn't represent establishment Democratic Party politics. But in the context of the Democratic primary, where the voters are people who are very highly identified as Democrats, people who in fact love the Democratic Party and see it as this force for good in the world that's defending, you know, egalitarian values against, you know, a revanchist right, you aren't going to win all those people over by running in the primary against the party. And that was totally foreseeable. And people were making that argument. And, you know, it isn't some kind of, like, compromise with the forces that are that were arrayed against Bernie to say that it was a problem that his campaign was not able to shift its posture sufficiently
to being that unifying candidate at the moment where it was most possible for him to win. And that's my, you know, shitty, depressing, everybody on the left can hate me perspective about that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something to that. I think I would, at the level of messaging, mostly agree with you. The one thing I would add to that is that, I mean, that you're right. I mean, the tension or the paradox of the Bernie campaign always has been that he's trying to win the nomination of the party he says is failing.
Yeah.
And right. Or that he's criticizing. And I think to pull that off, you really have to thread the needle.
Yep.
And I think partly what you're saying is he didn't do that and the campaign didn't do that.
And in some ways, for good reasons, because he actually hates the party, which he should. The party's terrible.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, all the reasons he kind of thrills us sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, contributes to some of his electoral difficulties in the primary. But I would just say one more thing, and this is another depressing point. I do not want to lean on this as an explanation for why Bernie lost, but I do think you just have to say that the concentric circles of like people who watch MSNBC take their political cues from, you know, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, reliably turn out in Democratic parties. In Democratic Party primaries, you know, there's a lot of overlap there.
Yep.
And that media, that kind of strain of the media just really hated Bernie.
Right.
And even then, after he had that crushing victory in Nevada, what happened? I mean, people have compared the media coverage of Bernie to Biden, Bernie after Nevada and Biden after South Carolina.
Right.
And just how much more negative. Yeah. The coverage of Bernie was, I mean, it was like he won Nevada and then they just pivoted to these rhetorical, like speculative questions like, but can he do X, Y, or Z next?
Chris Matthews saying that it was like the France falling during the Nazi occupation.
Right. Yes. And then we talked for a week about Cuba.
Yeah. Right.
And Bernie and praising their literacy program. And so, you know, I do think there's a way in which the people who vote in Democratic parties, they listen to the organs of the media that pretty much most hate Bernie.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. I think it ultimately maps in some ways with the same critique, which is that the Bernie campaign was correct in its analysis of the forces arrayed against it. But by constantly bringing attention to the forces arrayed against it without trying to change its attitude in a way that would basically inoculate itself against the criticisms of the forces arrayed against it.
Right.
It undermined itself. Like,
yes.
And so,
yeah, no, I agree with that. Yes.
The thing is that, like, that shit was gonna happen. And, and you know, like, and it, again, it's always connected to things that I love about Bernie. So, like, Bernie doesn't play ball with journalists. He doesn't flatter them. You remember the big thing where he was like, I'm not gonna call you on your birthday. I'm not trying to.
Right, right.
But that's also another indication of the way in which he's sort of like temperamentally, politically, and ideologically unwilling to play the game that he might have needed to play in order to win this primary. Mm-hmm. You know, he continued to run against the media and run against the party. And the people in the party and the media are, you know, like sensitive losers who want to be told that they're like really, really lovely. And he was unwilling to do that. And that's why we love him, but that's also potentially why he lost. And I think that it's maybe an underappreciated fact that like there actually was a profound consolidation of self-understood liberal forces in the wake of Trump's election that did not exist during the 2016 election, where a lot of people who were the most active Democratic voters, the people who are going to show up for primaries, came to identify with like CNN commentators who went hard against Trump on Russia and MSNBC people who who cheerleaded impeachment and the party itself as the force that was like holding Trump accountable. The existence of the resistance as an actual like phenomenon in the like political imaginary of American Democratic voters made it harder for Bernie to run within the Democratic primary as an outsider of those institutions.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. Okay. This is a question from Twitter. Someone asked us, what are y'all's backgrounds? How did you become both experts and critics of the right?
Okay.
And perhaps, you know, experts might be, I don't know if I'll adopt that term.
Definitely not deserved when it comes to me.
But that general question of our backgrounds, maybe how we got into this. I was thinking too, you know, some of the ground we covered in like our very first episode, I don't know if everyone's gone back and listened to that first episode, which was a bit more biographical. So maybe, yeah. I don't want to say summary versions of that, but maybe we could cover some of that ground here. Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Who are we? Why are we? Why did this happen?
Yeah.
Well, Matt, do you want to give a little bit of your background?
I mean, my role on the show is as the ex-conservative. And
right. People know that.
People know that about me. And it just means that, you know, not only did I have firsthand experience of a lot of these institutions that we describe and, you know, some of the foundations and donors and, you know, things like the Intercollegiate Studies Institute and Institute for Humane Studies and Liberty Fund. And, you know, there's, you know, the whole network of the right, I was a part of that. And so I can speak to that with firsthand experience. But also because I was mostly, I would say, engaged with the self-described like intellectual wing of the conservative movement, mm-hmm. it means a lot of the texts and history and books and figures associated with the post-war American conservative movement, those were things I've studied and read and like that shaped my own political thinking when I was younger. And so I think a fair amount of the kind of intellectual work I've done by reading Russell Kirk and Bill Buckley and Eric Voegelin and Frank Meyer and Richard Weaver and, you know, the kind of canonical list of conservative intellectuals from that era, I've spent a lot of time with them. And so, but the thing is, maybe I'll just say this and hand it over to you, Sam. I never knew what to do with that information.
Right.
It doesn't always lend itself to just being a part of a, you know, an essay you're writing or some piece you're working on. And this podcast is a good way sometimes for me to just share anecdotes that in the context of discussing this or that thinker or text or whatever are kind of interesting, but, you know, never would have found their way into other parts of my work.
My background is that I've never been a conservative, and I grew up in like a left liberal household with like lawyer parents who one is a labor lawyer and one's a legal aid lawyer, and became a socialist when I was in college. So I encounter the right in such a fundamentally different way from Matt. But that has also happened to generate in me like an intense interest in these ideas. And I think that like there was some point at which I had a revelation, which is maybe wouldn't be such a revelation to many other people, but to me it was sort of like the feeling that I had when I read Marx for the first time, and that I felt when I read C.L.R. James and W.E.B. Du Bois, and the sort of like the sort of canonical texts that made me feel like alive to the to ideas in the world, that people who are conservative intellectuals had the same experience with a different set of texts. The reality of that parallel experience made me very interested in what it is that draws people to those texts in the way that I was drawn to the other ones, and what sorts of community are institutional or social are formed around that canon, and like what it feels like to have the kind of rites of passage of reading particular things to become a part of a movement that feels like something that jives with your sense of the world and which gives you a way of interpreting phenomena in the world that, like, you know, provides that intellectual sustenance that I like was starving for as a young person. I definitely, when I first became a left winger, the joy of it was having answers for every question at hand immediately. You know, it's like what's actually depicted in a lot of like anti-communist memoirs, like Arthur Koestler, about like when you first read Marx and all of social phenomenon around you fall into order and become legible in this like satisfying way where everything makes sense. And I definitely sort of had a conversion experience like that as a teenager. And then later on, I mean, I think that I've come to adopt an intellectual attitude of much more humility and curiosity. And so what I find invaluable about reading the right is trying to inhabit the minds of the people that I think are fundamentally wrong. And I think that like a failure to inhabit the minds of our opponents or trying to inhabit their minds is something that might be endemic to a certain kind of leftism, which I think you and I have tried to resist in this project.
Yeah. The only other point I'd make is, this might be a bit self-indulgent to say, but I do think now that Bernie has lost the primary, will not be the Democratic nomination, I do think my kind of immediate sense of political hope was tied to the possibility of Bernie Sanders becoming president. And I hate to admit that because I'm not like a Bernie fanboy. But nevertheless, in an immediate sense, I did think he was the best hope we had. And so I've really, and it, of course, this is so coincided with social isolation and the pandemic and self-quarantine, all that. But I've found myself really becoming extremely pessimistic politically and really retreating much more to literature and poetry. And in a way, I think since I'm a convert to the left, I've always struggled sometimes with both having the zeal of a convert and holding that intention with the value I put on, as you put it, humility and uncertainty, complexity, doubt. I've tried to hold those two things in tension, and I feel myself kind of veering much more back toward the latter. There was another question that asked about other right-to-left converts.
Sure.
Because most, the 20th century, I think the most famous converts were from left to right.
Or the most consequential.
The most consequential, yes. And I just wanted to say one quick thing about that, Sam. You can chime in too with whatever you might think about this. But it struck me that in the recent issue of Dissent, I led that conversation with Sarah Jones and Max Alvarez and Danny Jenkins about being people who grew up in, as it turns out, all conservative religious homes. And then moved left. And it strikes me that, you know, the people who moved from left to right in the mid-20th century, they, of course, came of age in an era when the left was like flush, right? Like in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, when, you know, a kind of, whether it was FDR in the United States being president, but also like
Popular Front,
an actual Communist Party too, you know, Popular Front, all that. Like, so if that's the age in which you came up in, you react against it in a way. And I thought it was notable that Sarah and Max and Danny and I are probably all, you know, either from late 20s to like mid to late 30s, right? So we came of age during the Reagan era.
Right.
Right. And when the religious right was dominant, and then the Bush presidency. And I suspect in the decades ahead, a lot of people around our age will have been right to left converts. And it'll be a different story than the 20th century because, well, we came of age when different factors were kind of on the rise.
Do you think that there are other, besides yourself and the people we've talked about, important figures of that right to left transition who are either playing an important role right now or played an important role in the latter half of the 20th century who haven't been sort of lifted up?
You know, we mentioned Michael Lind earlier. Mm-hmm. He actually wrote a book in the 90s called Up from Conservatism.
Yeah.
And he had been, I want to say he was kind of one of Buckley's many possible heirs during a certain period of time. You know, David Brooks was one, Michael Lind was one, Richard Brookhiser was one.
And that's a reference to Buckley's book, Up from Liberalism.
Right.
Right.
Yes. So eventually Lind broke with the kind of movement conservatism and wrote a really scathing book called Up from Conservatism that really, the charges he levels are pretty unanswerable. But then he's a hard to categorize figure now.
Right.
So I don't know where I would fit him in, but he definitely was someone on the right in a formal sense, like institutionally. He was a movement conservative, close with Buckley, and then he became something else. So he would be another one.
Yeah, I think there's probably more people than we're aware of who are actually very specifically in our generation who adopted maybe from a conservative upbringing initially a kind of the libertarian reaction.
Yeah.
Which was like the way to be
yes.
rebellious from your like conservative yeah. Christian traditionalist upbringing was to become like a Rand Paul libertarian who supported like weed legalization. Yeah. And,
totally. I mean, I kind of went through that phase. I mean, the joke used to be, what do you call a libertarian?
What do you call a libertarian?
A gay conservative.
There's that specific experience, and then there's just this sort of broader like libertine impulse yeah, yeah. of a young person who's been fettered by their traditionalist yeah, conservative yeah. upbringing, who maybe doesn't have the language uh-huh. or like community to rebel to the left, but has this other off-ramp, which is to be sort of laissez-faire yeah. in social and cultural issues. Uh-huh. I mean, I know that Sean McElwee had that experience yeah. too, and
yeah.
somewhat of a controversial left yeah. these days.
Yeah.
But I think that Sean might be representative of some other conversion narratives that
yeah.
maybe are less well-known.
Yeah, and I would just add one more wrinkle to that, which is I think another, if we're talking conversions, it's less of a dramatic conversion, but I think there are a lot of people, I would kind of fit my trajectory into, it intersects with this story a bit, but, and I think someone like David Kleon would be another example, or even John Gans, you know, who we talked about,
right.
was on the podcast recently. People who like circa the Obama years were kind of Obama liberals.
Yeah.
And it was kind of the experience of seeing, I think, how the right reacted to Obama and right. and then the kind of failures of the Obama years or some of the unmet expectations, you know, how people reacted to that is really interesting to me. And I think a decent amount of what we think of as like the Twitter left, you know, or people I think most of our listeners probably follow or read, you know, I think a decent number of us were people who were more or less Obama-ish. We wouldn't have really thought of ourselves as being on the left. And then, you know, when the choice, you know, over in the years that followed, and then when Bernie came along, you know, that kind of combination of our experience of the Obama years plus the rise of Bernie, I think moved a lot of us in a pretty forcefully in a particular political direction.
Totally. Yeah. When I started at school in college, it was 2008. So like I was going to Nashua every weekend to do canvassing mm-hmm. to Nashua, New Hampshire from Providence. And like genuine, like not jaded excitement about the possibilities for like some kind of new liberal hegemony inaugurated by our first black president, who is certainly sort of plausibly depicted as a liberal lion during the campaign yeah. was like really, yeah, it was a real, real feeling. Of course, I had like cynical anarchist friends who I remember on the night of him winning, beating McCain, so went down to where the state capitol was, and you know, it was a big rally, just like spontaneous excitement about Obama being elected, and the anarchist kids were chanting, Obama 08, no borders, no states. Just to troll us. Of course, you know, these people were right about the fact that our kind of naive hope for liberalism to triumph was wrong. But we did get a few questions about COVID and the right, but just sort of to combine them together so we can have this discussion. I'm interested to hear, Matt, like, where do you think we are with the pandemic and the politics that it's creating right now?
By my lights, we entered a new phase of the response to the pandemic in the United States when Trump very clearly said, fuck it, and went in with the state protesters
yeah.
and started picking fights with governors and kind of yeah. set up that dynamic where the new kind of terrain of debate is what's Trump doing versus what are these governors doing? And that becomes the site of conflict rather than how is the federal government responding to this pandemic? And
yeah,
you know, where we go from that, I really do not know, but it's a pretty dark place. Again, like with the FBI stopping like trucks to see if they have masks on them because right. a hospital administrator figured out a way to get his doctors and nurses masks.
Yeah.
To be stockpiled to what end? I don't know. All we know is that Jared Kushner is the one who apparently is like overseeing the stockpile, right? But there's no national plan to do what, you know, it would be one thing if Trump said, okay, here's the plan. the federal government will gather all the masks we possibly can and then distribute them on the basis of urgency of need, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what's happening. This is total chaos. And I find myself rather sympathetic to the failed state pieces that we see emerging. It's not clear what the federal government can do. The CDC put out all those contaminated tests. We're not testing nearly enough people. There's, you know, it just seems like failure after failure at a practical level at every part of this response.
One thing that I was really struck by as a historical parallel, a repeating about the anti-lockdown protests, both the sort of like social composition of them and the way they were treated in the media, is it felt so similar to the Tea Party in the sense that there's a crisis which requires a massive federal response, but whose roots are in the fundamental problems with the system that have been created by neoliberalism, conservative economics, libertarian ideas, deregulation, the absence of any kind of like egalitarian solidarity economy. And in both cases, what happens is that there is a provisional solution to the crisis. In the first, in 2008, it was the banking bailouts and the massive relief package, which seemed massive at the time. It doesn't seem massive now. And now there was the lockdowns. And the first protests that capture sort of a spectacle of the American imagination in ways that are the reasons for which implicate the media's fucking myopia about like what counts as legitimate protests and who real Americans are and bullshit like that, is these protests that are basically revanchist conservative protests by more or less the same class of people, which is kind of like white business owner type people, like, you know, kind of like petite bourgeois white people in red states who are responding to their sort of like libertarian opposition to the government response to the crisis.
Yeah.
And that the left is nowhere, right? In the American imagination. Yeah. It's not true now that it couldn't have been the case that the protest engaged in by essential workers on a daily basis that was reported on in somewhat, but not like on CNN all fucking day about what the Amazon workers are doing on Staten Island or in Detroit, who are walking off and saying, these people don't give a shit about us. We're being forced to do this work because they don't give a shit about us and they're trying to make profit off of our labor. Like, those could have been the faces of the COVID protest moment, but they chose these people in the exact same way that they chose the Tea Party over, you know, like there were some protests, right? There was Code Pink did the protests outside of like banks, and there were like there was a moment in which, you know, the who owns the protest right now is up in the air. I feel this repeating, this historical repeating.
Well, and you see too the link between the way that kind of right-wing sensibility or a kind of right-wing approach to economics ends up fomenting the division that the right plays off of, in the sense of, like, maybe these petite bourgeois small business owners, maybe they wouldn't have freaked the fuck out if we had had an organized response with a clear message from the president that said, listen, like, here's how we're going to take care of you. Do not panic. We will pass legislation that if you are a small business owner, it will mean this for you,
right?
And so on and so forth down the line. And then actually had an administrative state capable of carrying out those orders.
Right.
It would have been a very different situation, or at least you can imagine a different scenario playing out.
They exacerbate the crisis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But they can rely on the ideological blinders of their
of their
foot soldiers. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, like, I think that's also a big part of it. This is like where we get to not like the ideological or intellectual substance of conservatism, but to its essential mutability, dynamism, and comfort with hypocrisy, contradiction, and dishonesty.
Yes.
So like Trump can't in any sensible way say liberate Michigan. Right? That doesn't fucking make any sense. Mm-hmm. You are the president of the United States. The CDC is making these recommendations. Yeah. People are watching you and your
scientific advisors make these recommendations every day about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. There's like a reality that exists that cannot, that your cheering on of these particular protests, they can't be reconciled.
Right.
But right-wingers don't fucking care. Conservatives don't care. He identifies the fact that like the affective kind of energy, the kind of like the feeling of where this thing that he identifies as his base, the movement, mm-hmm. the kind of the way in which he might be able to manipulate the media, and particularly the media on the right, to his advantage, is to just to say this thing. It doesn't fucking matter if it makes any sense with anything he said before. And that same thing is happening all over the right-wing media. You say this, you say that, you say that. Like you were saying the other day, like it's muddying the waters. It's just like, it doesn't matter. There doesn't have to be coherence. It doesn't have to be coherent. It just has to be basically a besieged mentality, a way of like communicating that we are being put upon by the big other, which is the government, despite the fact that the government is controlled by your God King.
Right. Yeah.
But the point being that like what the right almost always has on the left, at least as the left is manifested as like the mainstream Democratic Party politics that gets the level of attention that the right gets for all kinds of weirdo shit, is that the left will never do this kind of thing where it's just completely incoherent. They'll do terrible things, they'll make horrible decisions, but they are always trying to think about like, how does this fit with that thing and that fit with that thing, and how do we make this all kind of work? Like, you're saying that, I'm saying this, should we all be saying kind of the same thing? And like on the right, it's like, doesn't matter, like mutable dynamism, like just be in opposition to the enemy, dial into the like most compelling affective energy that is available, and just run with it, just live it.
Well, you know, Sam, another way of putting that is that the right thinks politically, and well, I wouldn't say the left, but at least the kind of progressive,
the lamest elements,
the Democratic Party, they do not think politically. And it occurred to me the other day that
they think jurisprudentially, they think legally.
Yes, but Sam, this is what occurred to me, and you know I'm right about this. It occurred to me that Dr. Fauci is the new Robert Mueller, and that it'll be an appeal to like the figure that represents norms, facts, logic, empiricism against, you know, and the critique of Trump will not be, or kind of the assessment of this whole moment we're in will not be like making a moral and political argument about like how our society treats people, how we're treating, you know, workers, especially black and brown workers, so on and so forth. It will end up being like it, like Trump doesn't believe the facts about the coronavirus.
Exactly.
And who gives a fuck about that?
Yeah. No. Right? No, that's exactly right.
Because who even knows what the facts are? I mean, according to all the Rusty Renos and Richard Epsteins and whatever, right? So this is where the muddying the waters really does pay off. But, you know, that will be the, like, Democrat response. Oh, Trump doesn't believe experts. Trump doesn't believe in norms. He didn't believe the experts and didn't believe facts. And that's really why they love, Cuomo. Because even though Cuomo is fucking shredding the budgets of, like, New York hospitals and healthcare and, you know, down the line, he stands up in front of fucking projector PowerPoint presentation and talks about facts and logic.
Facts and logic.
They love him. So Cuomo now is the new hero of all the normie Dems I follow on like Facebook especially.
It's just incredible that despite what we've been through over and over, the Lucy and the football shit with well, these indisputable facts will come and save us from the political reality that we're living through has just proven to be not the case over and over and over again. Indisputable facts will not save us from a political reality in which our ideological opponents are committed over and above whatever the indisputable facts are to their ideological agenda. Like, they figured that out. And our fucking loser leaders in this political party still haven't figured it out.
I know, it's amazing.
And I'm an empiricist. I want real things correspond to reality. It drives me crazy.
Of course so. That's not the end in itself.
It's just getting distracted.
It's a tool. Knowing things about reality is a tool to engage with to kind of build the world you want to. It's not an ideology in itself.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that the right wing has created this epistemic terrain in which truth and facts don't matter, and you can constantly just sort of change. Last week on my Fox News show, we were saying don't worry about the coronavirus, and this week we're saying it's the worst thing ever, and we never said it was bad.
Right.
There's no arbiter. No matter how many times on the Daily Show they show the fact that Fox News said this thing one day and this other thing the next day. That feels good to you. But that's not the same thing as winning. That's not the same thing as affecting political outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Epistemology is not coming to save you from fucking ontology. Their boot is on the necks of the people that we supposedly support, whether or not they say that the boots aren't there.
Yes. Sam, I think to put it differently, the United States does not have a manager.
Yeah, you can't.
There's no one you can appeal to. There's no tennis judge, right? Or referee or umpire you can appeal to and say, that was a low blow, right? Trump didn't tell the truth.
Yeah.
It's really depressing.
We're sounding like Schmidians, man.
I did have one final question I think we should answer.
Okay.
And this is a fun one. We'll make it quick.
Okay.
Since Know Your Enemy hasn't done one of the posts with the four photos of your political beau ideals, who would they be for you? Mm-hmm. And that is from John on Twitter.
Okay.
My friend John, actually. I remember when he tweeted that.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I think my four would be Abraham Lincoln.
Uh-huh.
Frederick Douglass.
Uh-huh.
Herbert McCabe, who was a Catholic socialist, a Dominican.
Dominican, yeah.
Yeah, but really badass. And then Dorothy Day.
I was certain you were going to get Dorothy Day in there. That's so beautiful. Those are such good choices, Matt.
And I think they do. Those are actually, I haven't written or talked about Frederick Douglass before, or even really Lincoln that much, but I have a minor obsession with Lincoln, and when I was teaching this course at the University of Virginia on American political thought, really I really was blown away by Frederick Douglass. I really think he's one of the true badasses of American history. So those were Lincoln, Douglass, Dorothy Day, and Herbert McCabe. And I would just say, on a final exam I gave in this class I just mentioned, someone mistook Frederick Douglass for Stephen Douglass. And I just want to say, those are very different people.
In the sense that they kept writing.
Yes. Like a blue book essay prompt where I said Frederick Douglass. And
I hope that you didn't downgrade them too much for that.
I forget what I did. I actually think the student remembered and got home and emailed me right away.
That's nice.
I can assure you I was merciful and generous, as I always am.
You are merciful. Okay, my answers, which I will not dwell on. The first is Ella Baker, who maybe listeners will be aware of if they studied the Black freedom struggle closely, but she is one of the background figures in the civil rights movement, somebody who mentored people like Diane Nash and Stokely Carmichael / Kwame Ture, Rosa Parks, and was the main advisor to SNCC.
Oh, yeah.
So one of her famous quotes was, "The movement made Martin." Wasn't that Martin made the movement. And she represents the reality that political struggle involves very smart, careful, and thoughtful organizing.
Yeah.
Every fucking day. You know, people talk about the boring of boards.
The slow boring of boards, the Weber quote.
The Weber quote. But they don't really think about that in terms of organizing. But the organizing actually functions in the same way. You have to have people like Ella Baker building over and over, day after day, creating the organizing capacity to engage in these movement struggles.
Yeah.
And so I've always been a big believer in her. I'll say fewer things, but other people. Ella Baker, W.E.B. Du Bois,
a black socialist who, reading Black Reconstruction, his book about the Reconstruction period, was a very important thing in making me a socialist and thinking about how Marxism plays out in the American context. Incredible book. Third, Antonio Gramsci, which Matt knows because he's edited me talking about like hegemony.
Yeah.
And my fourth one is Victor Jara, the Chilean musician who wrote some of the most beautiful songs about socialism in Latin America and was murdered by the fascists during the takeover of Chile by Pinochet, who then was advised by the people we spoke about with,
I know.
With Marshall the other day, the Chicago school.
Yeah.
And Victor Jara was murdered in a stadium along with many other leftists. But if the listeners haven't listened to Victor Jara's music, it's heartbreakingly gorgeous.
By the way, as it turns out, a lot of terrible Catholics were involved with Pinochet.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's not surprising. But Frederick Martel's book, In the Closet of the Vatican, it was really shocking how complicit Catholic nuncios, kind of meaning like the ambassador to a certain country, how the worst of them, especially when it came to sex abuse, were also very into fascism, as it turns out. So anyways, we don't need to get into that. Martel's book was a real revelation on the Catholic Church in Latin America during that period. I'll just say that.
Something we can forget about conservatives, which is that, you know, there's a version of conservatism that maybe you and I are more sympathetic to, which is the sort of nostalgia for a lost sense of plenitude and community and calm and the near and dear. But conservatism, reactionary politics are often also bound up with a desire for fucking violence and blood and if you're besieged, then you're fighting. And like, you know, like why people have identified like Ernst Jünger's books as like so important for understanding like fascist aesthetics is like the ideal of the like of war making and violence as like sort of the purifying impulse of a people. That stuff is always there.
Yeah.
Usually. Should we call it? We've been going on.
Yeah. Well, thank you, listeners, for sending in your questions.
Yeah.
We didn't get to all of them. And we might do something like this somewhat more regularly. We've talked about different ways of doing it. It's not clear what we're going to decide, but, you know, some way of interacting regularly with our listeners.
Right, we will. And I'll just make a note here that we actually answered a few more of your questions, but they had to be cut for time in this episode, which is already quite long. But if you want to hear those, you can sign up on Patreon, and we're going to release a couple more answers as a bonus episode. And one of those questions is Matt and I geeking out for a good 15 minutes about Bob Dylan. Sort of, where does he fit in sort of American political history and life? And is he a conservative? Is he a liberal? And is that even the right question to be asking about him? Spoiler, we think it's not the right question. But if that sounds good, plus some even nerdier discussion of political realignments and political science, sign up on Patreon. $5 a month gets you access to the whole archive of bonus episodes, including that one.
What should we sign off with, Sam?
I was thinking maybe we could end with a Dylan quote or something.
Well, I have my favorite Dylan quote ready at hand. So
okay, yeah, go for it.
Steal a little, they throw you in jail. Steal a lot, they make you a king.
Yeah, very good.
It's so perfect.
And the line right before that, which is not quite as good, but definitely know your enemy appropriate, which is, they say that patriotism is the last refuge to which a scoundrel clings. All right, well, thanks so much, everybody, for sticking with us. And we'll do this again soon.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.